This is It Cinema Squabble, episode number 15. Who are we? What do? We are a number of Seattle's film critics. And you know what? For years, we've been gathering in theaters talking about film, and we decided, you know, let's bring this to you in podcast form. And that's exactly what we're here doing. My name is Adam Gerke. Joining me in studio, Sarah Michelle Fetters.
Hello, hello, hello.
You come to us from Seattle Gay News. Brian Zitzelman, you come to us from The Examiner.
I have a maybe deep voice. I don't know. High voice, deep voice?
I don't know.
It's something. It's a voice.
You've got a voice.
We've got a voice.
We've all got our voices. We've got film to talk about.
Lots of film.
My God, we took 3 weeks off. This is the price we pay.
I blame it on Magic Mike. Too much quality for one body to take.
Too much pony.
I'm going to blame it on Jaws. I saw Jaws last week. It was all your fault.
Could be that too. So let's just kick into this Ant-Man. Brian.
Ant-Man.
Set it up.
Marvel Cinematic Universe, aka Disney Marvel. It is the newest superhero movie. It is Ant-Man. It's a man who can turn to the size of an ant. There's not much more to it. It's the first brand new Marvel superhero in a few years. I think Captain America was the last time they rolled out a new one, and that was, what, 2010? 2011. So we've had a few years.
You don't qualify Guardians of the Galaxy as a rollout of a new
superhero? That's a whole group, which has some of the less different dynamic than I think this movie, which has a lot of backgrounds to set up. But maybe we're putting the cart before the ant.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, tell us about what is Ant-Man?
Ant-Man is about a character played by Paul Rudd, who plays Scott Lang, who plays a ex-criminal, but not a bad ex-criminal, so to speak. He robbed rich people, nonviolent specifically, other than some fisticuffs in jail, just
a cat burglar.
He was a cat burglar, yes.
Oh, so he's Cary Grant.
He's Cary Grant.
Okay.
Yes, Paul Rudd is the new Cary Grant. Sarah said it first and probably last. But he gets out of jail. He does not want to do any more bad things, any more gigs, but he gets drawn back to it because he can't get a job. Even at Baskin Robbins will not keep him.
And Baskin Robbins finds out.
They find out everything.
They do. That's their thing. So he gets drawn back into the world of crime, which coincidentally ties him into a man named Hank Pym, played by Michael Douglas, who is a gentleman who we find out early on made these things called Pym particles, which you find out can make human flesh and tissue shrink, tiny size, but still man strength. In fact, more than man strength, ant strength, which I don't know why that happens, but they're stronger than normal. So Rudd, Scott Lang character, gets tied to the Michael Douglas character when he goes to rob his house. Thinks he's just going to find a safe, thinks he's just going to run into some normal fun goodies, some gold, some jewels, finds a suit, wackiness ensues, and he gets tied into the Ant-Man thing to stop a bad guy who used to work with Pym, who's also trying to create his own things for possibly nefarious reason, possibly military reasons. Bad things ensue. Superheroics ensue. Plot ensues. Lots of characters ensue.
Typical Marvel silliness.
Yeah.
So we're saving the world from
Marvel silliness.
We're saving the world from Hydra once again.
Yes.
And
he's not quite Hydra. I mean, he's going to sell. So the bad guy's played by Corey Stoll. He's Hank Pym's former protege who's all mad at him because he didn't believe in him and he kind of thought he was psychotic, which, hey, he is. And he's just going to sell this technology to the highest bidder who happens to be Hydra.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of warmed over.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot of fun.
It's occasionally fun. It's a little dull, and it's very much the Disney Marvel thing, which is the villain is not fleshed out, but decently played. The cast is well done. The comedy is solid, but the whole is kind of lacking.
See,
didn't you think, Adam? Are you a little stronger on this?
I felt the actual film was overall, it worked just fine.
Ringing endorsement.
Right, just fine. Here's the thing. I think what actually saved the film for me, more than anything else, is Paul Rudd. I think his ability to be the common guy and to be the action hero all rolled into one, and his sort of sense of comedic timing in general is what saves this whole film. And if it wasn't Paul Rudd, I don't know if the film would actually work, to be honest.
I do love the fact that the film is basically a comedy with a heist movie hiding in it. And I know that that probably had a lot to do with Edgar Wright's early influence, but I do love the nature of that it's such a it's different enough from the Marvel template in that fashion that I was amused.
It made me giggle, which is kind of their fashion, to have the set template with the slight variation.
But I will say, I think you can tell where the Edgar Wright movie. So Edgar Wright was originally supposed to write, direct, do all this thing with this film, and then the quote creative differences ensued. I think you can tell where the Adam McKay, Peyton Reed movie starts and the Edgar Wright movie ends. There is definite, I think, a tonal imbalance at times within the film.
Which is part of my problem with the movie. I do think there's a tonal balance throughout. It's trying to be a little too humorous at times where it's supposed to be dramatic, which kind of undercuts the dramatic. And the dramatic's not good enough to give it the real push kind of towards the end. And the villain, and I like Corey Stoll. And mm-hmm. he plays Psycho well, but man, he's given nothing to do.
Yeah.
He's your typical bland CEO / maniacal villain.
Yeah.
What I will say that I liked about the film, though, and I thought this was the first time in a long time we've seen this effectively used 3D in this film.
I agree totally.
Because
I completely agree.
I saw it in Cinerama non-3D, so
okay,
I cannot confirm nor deny.
What you get is you get when he shrinks into Ant-Man and he flies through a lock tumbler, or he flies through this or goes through that. The world actually works. It's much the way that Scorsese's
Hugo
works, where you're going in through the clockworks or you're going in through the train station. This is very similar in that way. And I thought that was great then. I think it's great here.
The use of perspective in this film,
mm-hmm.
I thought was sensational.
Yeah.
The balance between looking at the world from our normal point of view and also this microscopic size really works in a way that I don't think we've seen before, even going back to Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or the... You know, the Amazing Shrinking Man.
Yeah, I think it goes back
Incredible
to the
Shrinking Man.
Incredible Shrinking Man from the 50s or 60s,
yeah,
whenever
was. You keep going back and back. You could go to, you know, all of those other films. I don't think we've seen it quite like this before, and I was very impressed by that.
And some of it's rather seamless. I mean, the ants are obviously CG ants and all stuff, but there's a big fight scene towards the end of the movie on a helicopter where he's shrinking in and out and going small, going big, throwing punches that really kicks. And
it does.
There's kind of a finale around that involved a briefcase and a great song from The Cure that is really, mm-hmm. really top-notch clever stuff.
It is. Well, and the whole thing in the little girl's room on top of a train set.
That is, I thought that was brilliant.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know a lot of people, when they saw the original trailer, there was people kind of going, hey, wouldn't it be cool if the movie actually climaxed on that train set, if that's as big as it gets? And it kind of does. And it works really well.
Yeah. It's a nice ensemble. Mm-hmm. It's a nice enough movie, but it did remind me of how in the early aughts there were so many of those first superhero movies in a genre or in a series, and usually you recall the second movie was the best one. The first one has to do all the heavy lifting. I think this movie is a little,
and if this
you feel,
gets,
I think you feel the heavy lifting enough.
Yeah, and if this gets a second movie, and if it can stay as self-contained, unburdened by the rest of the Marvel Cinematic Universe as this one is, I mean, there are a few little instances where they have to set stuff up, but by and large, this is the most self-contained Marvel movie in a long time, mm-hmm. where they're not doing heavy lifting for Avengers Infinity War or Civil War, although the kicker at the end, obviously...
Yeah.
gives you that, but that's not in the movie itself.
Right.
And no female leads.
And
though.
stay
the ladies away.
Well, but you do get sort of a hint of this, and do stay through the credits all the way through the credits to the end of this. So,
no, you don't have to stay. Listen, the secret. Mm-hmm. Don't stay through the credits. Go to YouTube the day it comes out. Those scenes are on there, and then you don't have to read all the names.
What?
Unless you're someone who naturally stays through the credits, respectful.
Sure.
But come on.
But unlike other Marvel movies, also. I would agree with Brian in this instance that you don't necessarily have to stay mm-hmm. because that's a scene that's actually been shot for Civil War that they've just dropped into this film.
Okay. So theater here. Sarah, where do you sit?
Theater.
Theater. And Brian, how about you?
I'll go Rent.
Rent for Brian. Okay. Two theaters, one Rent. Ant-Man. Minions. We had a chance to see Minions a couple weeks ago.
It's making all of the money.
It is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and
it has your money in the... It has your money.
It does.
It's left your pockets.
You've already seen it. We're not going to spend a lot of time on it. You know who these guys are. They're the little yellow pill-shaped, adorable...
Twinkies with eyes.
Twinkies with eyes from the Despicable Me movies. They get their own spinoff. It's how they meet Gru. If Gru mm-hmm. is the bad guy, good guy, whatever. The bad guy that becomes the good guy that's still bad in the Despicable Me movies. It's how they meet him. It's all the stuff that they do to find a new boss...
It's tedious.
It's set in 1968. Mm-hmm. They destroy London. They get to be around when the dinosaurs go extinct. So how I kind of explain it to people is...
Here we go.
Well, so how I explain this to people is in the Ice Age films, mm-hmm. we all love Scrat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Scrat is probably our favorite character.
Absolutely.
We love the little Scrat vignettes.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want a whole Scrat movie.
No. Yeah.
The Minions are great. in the Despicable Me films. They're adorable. They're cute. They're funny. They should have remained Scrat.
Mm-hmm.
They don't need their whole movie. They don't need their own movie.
I feel confident you could probably turn on any 5 minutes of Minions and be pleasant, you know, be amused. And if you watch 6 minutes and you're like, okay, 7 minutes, 8 minutes.
But once you hit that 10-minute mark, you're in trouble.
Yeah. You are.
And with Minions for me, I'm sitting there going, I'm feeling tired. It had a hard time keeping me awake. I got to be honest.
Same joke over and over again for 90 minutes.
Ran dry.
And Sandra Bullock's weirdly bad in it.
I thought she was pretty, just kind of monotone. Yeah. What is it? Monochromatic? Monochromatic.
Yeah, which is weird because everybody else is actually pretty decent to actually pretty good. But she phones this one in. She definitely just picked up a paycheck.
Oh. Yeah.
And the movie is, I know a lot of people are more angry about this than maybe we are, but it's oddly violent. I mean, not just in a Looney Tunes, Tom and Jerry sort of way, but almost in an itchy and scratchy parody sort of way.
Hmm. Well, yeah, the Looney Tunes is usually the animals get hurt, they get blown up, and then you see him walking in the next scene. This guy's dead. He's a human. He's dead. And all his clones are dead, too. They're dead. Dead.
I don't know. That didn't bother me. So, all right, Minions. I think we're all kind of on the same page there.
Skip.
Which brings us to Amy, talking about Amy Winehouse, the documentary out that came out kind of encapsulating her life from age 14 until her expiration in her 20s.
27 Club.
Yes, yeah, she's in the Forever 27 Club. So this basically picks up from her singing at a birthday party, seeing unseen footage, kind of following her through her relationships, boyfriends become husbands, become drug partners, going to rehab. You and I saw this film.
I've seen this film. Yeah. It's a very solid documentary.
Mm-hmm.
It really reframes, I think, for some people who've lost, that Amy Winehouse really was a pretty terrific artist and singer. And it contextualizes the downfall, and that it was not as steady as it was. Like, in my mind, it was she died at 2008. There was the big year in 06, 07, things started to fall apart. When they were getting to 2009, 2010, 20, I'm like, I forgot she still was moving along.
She was still hanging in there. And, you know, what this did for me is I remember all of this kind of like it was yesterday, and I remember at the time thinking, God, I really don't like this girl. She seems like just kind of a bratty English girl from, you know, well, from England. And at this point, I'm like, so what? I don't really care. I don't care about your music. I don't care about you. I didn't care about her until I saw this film. And then I suddenly had a newfound respect for her talent and her ability, which was otherwise, I think, completely obscured by the fact that she just seemed so snotty all the time. I didn't like her for her personality then.
The doc does a great job also of showing how the downfall, the spiral happens. You see, like, the dad just taking advantage of situations. A daughter who just wants to be with their dad, and a dad who wants to not innately exploit it, but just enough that just furthers all the things along. My only issue with the movie, I feel like you don't get a proper sense of who Amy is enough. You get the people around her. I'm not sure you always get a sense of her herself.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd say theater.
Yeah, and I would too. See it in the theater. You'll get a newfound respect for Amy Winehouse, indeed. Mr. Holmes, another film that a number of us had a chance to see during the Seattle International Film Festival.
And a film you and I liked a lot.
Very much so. And this is basically Sherlock Holmes, age 90 and age 60, kind of a time flopping thing from just post-World War II and then dating back to Holmes's last final case, which Holmes, played by Ian McKellen, for those who are
Sir Ian McKellen.
Also Magneto. So if you're trying to put that together, which guy is this that I'm talking about? basically, Holmes comes home and he's losing his mind and he's trying to retain to what bits he has and trying to solve this last case one more time. Also,
but not so much solve the case as he wants to write down what happened factually in that last case that led him to retire.
As best he can.
Yeah.
So he's trying to tell one more story, remembering that Watson was the one who actually penned a lot of the Dr. Holmes or Mr. Holmes stories. So Holmes himself now trying to write the story, he doesn't write it with the same panache and flair. And so that has a kind of different meaning to him, trying to remember all these bits and pieces.
So this is a fiction kind of presenting things almost as a nonfiction, right? And this is nothing. I'm not an expert. This has nothing to do with any Conan Doyle based.
No, it's inspired by Conan Doyle, but it's not.
Yeah. Okay. But I will say...
Based on the book by Mitch Cullen.
Right. I will say, McKellen, beautiful in this film. The score, beautiful. The cinematography, gorgeous. Overall, this is the film. This is one of my favorites from this summer, and I can't get enough of it. I want to see more of that.
Laura Linney, equally spectacular.
Yep.
This is one of the better roles and better performances she's had in ages. And the little kid that plays Roger, her son, that Holmes is doing most of his discussions and debates and talks with as they tend to his bee farm over in the back. Milo Parker, also a wonderful child performance, one of the best we've seen this year. But what I love so much about this film is the balance between truth, fiction, and honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes finding the truth,
mm-hmm.
but telling a lie, can be the most honest thing that you do.
Yeah, and that involves an entire subplot, which we haven't mentioned here. We'll save it for folks to go see.
Sure. There's a lot of stuff going in post-war Japan that's very, very important.
Yeah.
And you don't realize how important it is until you get to the end of the film and this beautiful, bittersweet, heartfelt coda. You know, this is the best movie that director Bill Condon has made probably since Gods and Monsters, the last time he and McKellen killed it there. Yeah, yeah, Ian McKellen got an Oscar nomination for that. I know it's early, I know it's July, and unfortunately this movie is not doing the business right now, which I want it to do the business.
Yeah.
It's not doing the business right now that it maybe needs to be remembered, but Ian McKellen is giving one of the best performances you will see in all of 2015, and if we are not talking about him for potential Oscar consideration at the end of the year, there is something wrong with everybody.
Yeah, I'm hoping the producers have deep enough pockets that they're able to get the ads out when it comes to Oscar season, that they're able to get DVDs in the hands and go from there.
Can I ask one quick question, because I wasn't able to see the movie?
Mm-hmm.
All this sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the reason people may not be seeing it, if you've seen the trailer, you see the stuff, looks quaint.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that to sound bad, but I think some people are saying, like, this looks like a nice little movie that I will eventually catch up with on PBS in 3 years.
I would say some people probably look at it and go, it's too Masterpiece Theater.
Yeah, which I like Masterpiece Theater, but there's also the sense of, do I really need to rush out to see this for some?
Well, what I would say is all you people that got bamboozled by going to see Woman in Gold, go see this, because this is the better than BBC version.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, the producers have made it look like the BBC version.
Yeah, yeah.
But deeper, richer, far more profound, and surprisingly suspenseful at times, but in a way that's authentic.
Yeah.
Really, and a great mystery, a great central mystery at the heart of it all.
So, Sarah, you and I, we're theaters.
Theater, all the way, without a doubt.
So there you go. Pixels, Sarah, you're the only one that had a chance to check this out.
I know, you guys probably the biggest release of the week.
The biggest Adam Sandler fan I know, Sarah Michelle Fathers.
Oh, yes, Adam Sandler, he and I
Kevin
just
James,
love
Josh
each other.
Gad, Sarah's favorite.
Okay, so I'm going to go really quick on this. Pixels will probably be the biggest movie of the week.
Why? Why?
Nostalgia.
No, I mean, and here's the thing with Pixels. So Pixels is... It's a sci-fi fantasy comedy in a Ghostbusters vein about aliens believing that a capsule that we sent into space that had recordings of people playing video games was a challenge to them for supremacy of the galaxy.
Mm.
And so they send actual video games, 1982 video games, back to Earth to attack us.
Action comedy.
Yeah. I mean, so it's, you know, it's, you got Pac-Man actually going through the street of New York, gobbling up cars like they're pellets.
Which does not sound terrible.
It's a great premise, really.
Great movie.
And it's based on a short film, and I unfortunately haven't seen the short film, but I've heard the short film's fantastic. Here's what I'll say. This movie is much better than you think it is going to be. With Adam Sandler and Kevin James in it, you are really afraid that it's going to be something unwatchable.
Mm-hmm. I am very afraid.
Yes. And here is
afraid.
And here is what... And it is not bad.
That's not a raving
rave
review.
Of the century.
That does not make it good.
Theater rent skip. Not bad.
Yeah, no, it's not a bad movie, but it's not a good movie.
Uh-huh.
It's just flat.
Okay.
And that's the problem. There is never that sense of awe or excitement that Ghostbusters had.
Uh-huh.
Chris Columbus, the director, does what he can. And I will say it's probably the first time that Adam Sandler in one of these films has a real director working with him.
Huh.
And it shows visually. But the movie just is flat. It just flatlines.
Yeah.
There are a lot of positives. There's just not enough of them to make it worth seeing in a theater.
Okay. Well, so that'll be on the wait list for me. Brian, how about you?
Not seeing it.
Skip
me. I haven't seen it. It could be the greatest movie ever made.
I'm still going with a skip, but Adam Sandler fans are probably going
to
be
fine. They'll go to it in droves. You know what? We last night saw something by the name of Southpaw.
This was supposed to have Oscar chatter, and there's maybe still going to be some.
There probably still should be.
Uh-huh.
It's the... Jake Gyllenhaal has really been on a roll. I think we all know this.
Yes.
Some of it's been playing psychos and stuff, Nightcrawler, Enemy, playing stuff that cinephiles, particularly internet cinephiles like ourselves, kind of are more prone to. But he's been really good lately. And this is a boxing movie. He's really beefed up. He's big. Tragedy, all that kind of stuff. This is supposed to be an Oscar segue, and it is kind of a dud. It's from Antoine Fuqua, who still people say is the guy from Training Day, even though he's made like five or six or seven movies since then.
More than
and
that.
Kurt Sutter, who was the kind of main voice showrunner on Sons of Anarchy.
And The Shield.
So he plays, Gyllenhaal plays Billy Hope, who's the undefeated boxer. He's 43-0, though his skill seems to be less being a good boxer, more being able to get punched hard. And because he doesn't have any defense, he just constantly punches the other guy. He's getting a little punch drunk, and his wife's wanting him to get out of the boxing game. Wife's played by Rachel McAdams. And early in the movie, and depending on if you've seen the trailer or not, something happens.
It's not a spoiler. It's not a spoiler.
It's not a spoiler. I can say this. I try to just leave this out. So Rachel McAdams, who plays his wife, gets killed.
Yes.
And that just sends a big old spiral for Jake Gyllenhaal. He loses his house, his money, his daughter.
Loses it all,
bottoms out, and has to rebuild.
Yeah,
it's a skeleton of a movie with none of the meat on it. It's all exclamation points. It's the bad things happening and none of the in-between.
But don't forget the most important person helping him rebuild.
Curtis Jackson.
No.
Forrest Whitaker, who's actually my favorite part of this movie.
Tig Wills, the coach.
The coach. Yeah. And it's a lot of cliches. And cliches can be fine, and cliches can work. I think we've all seen movies that are predictable, and that's not innately a bad thing, but it has none of the in-between, none of the joy that kind of makes going through those predictable points worthwhile.
Well, the problem, boxing movies follow a certain template at this point.
Yeah.
Since the 1930s, boxing movies have pretty much followed the same exact template. B, this is a kitchen sink melodrama from the 1940s, meaning that it's heightened emotion, it's heightened melodrama, it's all that sort of stuff. The problem is, it doesn't just stop at the kitchen sink. It throws in the refrigerator, it throws in the cupboards, it throws in the microwave, it throws that big, huge freezer that your grandma had in the back that was filled with 22 years of meat.
I was going to say fish.
The meat is in there. They're boxing the meat.
Perch.
You know, it's all in there. And at a certain point, it's just too much.
Just stop already, yes.
There is a good movie inside this film because the performances, I think across the board, the performances are fantastic. It just doesn't know when to quit with the dramatics. Mm-hmm. Everything bad has to happen at every single point
of
this
film. And those
are
the only parts. It's only the big downfall parts and only the big upticks and none of the in-between.
But
and it just makes it so hollow.
But it's so frustrating because, you know, there's one point in the movie where Forrest Whitaker and Jake Gyllenhaal have this beautiful scene. They're sitting in a dark, empty gym and they're having this heartfelt, authentic conversation, and it oozes authenticity, but leading into that conversation
is centered around
one of the most, biggest slaps to the face that
Absolutely.
You will ever have involving a minor character that shouldn't have been in the movie in the first place.
In fact, those are the only scenes to me that really have any pop are the ones with Whitaker, who's really great in this movie and is given a little bit of a shading.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's the old wise trainer, but he's given some extra moments. Like there's a scene where he's first introduced to Gyllenhaal. He's like, I don't drink. I don't drink. No drinking here. I don't want any drink. Gyllenhaal offers to buy him a beer. He says, nope. They go to a bar. He sees him drinking. He's like, I thought you said didn't drink. He's like, can a man take on new hobbies?
Yeah.
And those scenes are pebbles of good things in an otherwise boring movie. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about Gyllenhaal for Oscar pre this, and I think post this and saying he's great. I'm not saying he's bad in the movie. He's very good. But I think to have a genuinely great performance, you have to have at least somewhat material to form something great around. He could have done that, but I can't call it a great performance because he's not given enough things to do.
And the moments I think that he is spectacular are all around with somebody else. Early on, you know, Rachel McAdams, the punch drunk scene that you were talking about, she's fantastic in this moment where she tells him he's punch drunk, where she basically tells him, you keep going like this.
In two years, you won't
be able to talk to you anymore. She's spectacular in that scene. And he is just, it's like jazz. She is, he is working with her, and they're just twisting and turning and weaving, and it's magnificent, and it makes you believe for a moment, this movie's going to be something. Hmm. And then it just... So it's all the script. Nobody knows when to say when.
And the editing.
Which is weird because as far as Antoine Fuqua is concerned, this is probably the least visually chaotic movie he has ever directed.
Yeah. Okay.
It's probably the most simple, straightforward. There's a lot of times where he just lets the scenes play out on their own. And I mean, even the late James Horner's score is very eloquent and sweet and simple, and it just augments the scenes. It doesn't telegraph the scenes,
I think the first half there might be a little too much. But
that being said, Sarah, where do you sit? Theater, rent, skip?
It's a rent because there's so much strong stuff in the film. I think people should see it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a definite mixed bag, unfortunately.
Okay.
There's no way I can say see this in the theater, but renting it just for the performances alone, definitely.
Okay.
Skip. Both these actors, all the good people in this have better stuff to see. There's better boxing movies to see. Spend your time with that.
Okay. And I'm in the rental category as well, feeling that as a person who doesn't really care about boxing, this actually did get me engaged enough to be interested in the boxers just enough to go, yeah, actually, I'm interested. And I did feel that some of the emotional points here and feel emotional about the boxers, that part worked for me as well. But more so for me, I do think there are plenty of flaws. But I'm still saying rent on that. So two rentals, one skip. So that is a ton of ground covered all in one fell swoop. And you know what? We have a special guest joining us here in the wings. Courtney Sheehan. She is the program director of the Northwest Film Forum. Courtney, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, Thanks for coming.
Tell us a little bit about, not necessarily where you come from yet, because we want to get to that in a second, but Northwest Film Forum, for folks who aren't familiar with what you guys do, what do you do?
Certainly. So Northwest Film Forum is a comprehensive independent film arts organization, which is a very long way of saying that we support local and regional film production and culture in all the ways that we can. Specifically, we have two theaters in Capitol Hill. We show independent films most nights of the year, both from around the region, around the country, and around the world. And we also have the largest children's film festival on the West Coast, which also tours nationally. And we also have a lot of artist support services. We rent out gear to filmmakers. We have an edit suite that's available to the public. We have fiscal sponsorship for features and a slew of other things. And then we also teach a lot of classes and workshops for filmmakers, everything from how to use a green screen, how to use Final Cut Pro, how to write a script. That's the way in which we endeavor to be comprehensive in our support of independent film.
Pro movies.
Fantastic.
Very pro movies.
Yeah, seriously.
And right here in the middle of Seattle.
In the middle of Capitol Hill. In the middle of the Pike Pine Corridor, no less.
Yeah, blocks away from where I live. So, I mean, I walk by your offices, I don't know, I wouldn't say a daily basis, but a regular basis.
A little stalker action.
Oh. Yeah.
I'm the same way. I'm up there all the time, having to go to the Seattle Gay News.
Fast.
Same block right there.
Yeah. Stranger right down the street as well, for that
exactly.
matter.
Exactly.
It's a happening block.
It is.
Yeah. So all this media all in one place. Give us a little bit of an idea on where you come from, because you are newer to the mix, just like within the last couple of years, I understand.
Yeah, so I've been at the Film Forum for just under 2 years, and I came most recently from doing a fellowship where I was traveling internationally to film festivals.
And that's the Watson Fellowship.
That is, indeed.
Tell folks a little bit about the Watson Fellowship, because I knew some folks in college who got the Watson Fellowship. This is a big deal.
It is a strange and wonderful thing. It's like secretly way better than a Fulbright, but nobody knows about it because so few colleges can nominate students for it. So it's a national foundation that gives out fellowships for students to do, like recent college graduates, to do a year-long project internationally that is essentially a passion project. There are only two rules of the fellowship. One, you cannot return to the U.S. for 1 year. Okay. And the other, you cannot be affiliated with an academic institution because it's intended to be an experiential fellowship. So I went to 20 film festivals in 8 different countries, and I did everything from volunteer at them, cover them as press, do research about the funding mechanisms within each country and how festivals are supported along with production, and then also, in one case, founded a festival in northern Spain called Cine Migratorio that was about migration.
Wow.
So how did you get picked? How did you apply for that? How do you get picked for that?
Well, there's a rigorous application process that involves essentially proposing the kind of project that you want to do, and specifically mine was called the Politics of Film Festivals, and this meant everything from the politics of programming to the kind of geopolitical relationships between festivals. Like, I spent a good amount of time in the countries of former Yugoslavia and looking at how those events reflected the kind of social and political and economic debris of the wars there.
Wow.
And then essentially just make the case that you're the best person to do this project and that you're going to wake up every day and do it even though no one's telling you what you have to do, because they just give you the money and then throw you out there into the world. So and then there's a national round of interviewing as well.
Crazy.
So how do you I know, that's like so crazy. And so how do you go from something like that, which is so expansive and massive, and I mean, you're dealing with a lot of heady, difficult subject matter while also just getting to experience international cinema. So how do you go from that to, if I remember right, you got your start working for the Children's Festival at the Northwest Film Forum?
Indeed. So when I was in college, I interned at the Film Forum. So this is like one of those rare cases of an unpaid internship that turns into a job. And perhaps ironically, it was the first unpaid internship of probably 7 or 10 of them. And so, you know, it's the one that really stuck. But that's where the programming bug bit me, because I was researching films to solicit for the Children's Festival. And I also met my predecessor at that time and was just like, wow, like, this is the job, just sharing movies with people. Because sort of voyeuristically, that's my biggest passion, is kind of looking back in the theater and seeing how people react to the experience of a film and having provided it for them, and specifically connecting audiences with films they wouldn't otherwise see because they're not in the commercial networks of distribution.
Tell us a little bit about the Children's Festival, though. That is probably my favorite thing that you guys do every year.
Right on.
It is just awesome, and I look forward to always getting that press release every year that it's coming up and, you know, we get to go cover it and talk about it. It just makes me feel giddy.
Glad to hear it. I mean, it is the biggest program that we do, and it is also truly international in scope. This past year, we had 175 films from 58 countries, which is more, you know, global representation than many just regular international film festivals have. So that's really terrific. And then it has this really expansive reach because actually last year, BAM Cinematheque in New York tapped our children's festival director to curate several programs for their kids festival. It travels to other festivals and theaters throughout the country. And then also right now, this summer, the kind of extension of that programming is that we teach a lot of filmmaking camps for kids. So the building is just bursting at the seams right now with young people learning how to make films. And a lot of them are coming from being audience members at the Children's Festival.
So when it comes to that, is that a lot of you? What's the research into putting that kind of festival together? Is that using your own personal favorites? How much of that is reaching out to other festivals, seeing what they're putting together, trying to make sure you mix it up versus people coming to you?
Yeah, so the Children's Festival is directed by this woman, Liz Shepard, who's been doing it at the Film Forum for 10 years, and she is the mastermind behind it. And she also was the director of the Chicago Children's Film Festival, which is the largest in the country. So she's really in this kind of rarefied circle of children's film experts. But she has an amazing team of volunteers and assistants that do a lot of research in terms of combing through those other festival programs, but also actively following filmmakers the same way you would when you discover someone when they're young and, yeah, you know, premiere their first film. There's a lot of relationships like that, as well as just, you know, pure discovery. So last year, I think there were two films that ended up being Oscar nominated that were in the program that we had programmed before they got those nominations. So, yeah.
That was good. That was good.
And now, what do you have on the docket? Because I just got an email that something's happening this weekend.
Yeah, so there's a lot of things happening this weekend. We're opening a new film called Do I Sound Gay? That's a documentary about the gay voice, air quotes. And that features Dan Savage, David Sedaris, and George Takei. So that's really exciting to keep providing kind of queer film and queer art in a neighborhood that is specifically kind of being contested right now around the culture and the, you know, really strong history of the identity of Capitol Hill as the center for the queer community. But, you know, the kind of character of the nightlife right now, and that neighborhood is increasingly moving toward away from the gay neighborhood, from being the gay neighborhood. And I think I recently read in the Times that there are 20% fewer same-sex households in Capitol Hill than there were 10 years ago.
Yeah,
so,
I think they're calling it gay flight at this point.
Sure.
That the Hill is not quite the mecca that it was even just a few years ago.
But then you juxtapose that documentary that's going to be playing with, you've still got a pigeon sat on the branch reflecting on its existence, which is one of the worst titles ever, even though it's an awesome movie.
No, it's great. It's great.
I'm
it's
sorry.
Just hard to sell it to people.
Oh, my goodness. But you've got that continuing. You've got the Scarecrow Not on Netflix program.
Yeah, that's tonight,
and
actually.
That's tonight.
I'm going to run
oh,
back up the hill
okay.
and intro
so,
it.
Oops.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, these are ongoing things, though. So what are some of the ongoing projects that you guys have that you're working on right now?
Yeah, so Not on Netflix is actually a new series with Scarecrow to kind of both, you know, bring awareness and attention to many of the amazing titles in the Scarecrow library that you can't access online. And, you know, there's increasingly this sense that there's less of an urgency around going to the movies to see something because you can just probably find it online, right? But we have such a rare resource in Seattle with Scarecrow.
Absolutely.
And we're mm-hmm. really trying to kind of highlight that specificity in terms of that cultural resource with this new program. So we're doing that. And then right now I'm also in the thick of organizing local sightings, which is our long-running Pacific Northwest Festival of Films and Filmmakers from this region. So that encompasses Washington, Oregon, Montana, Idaho, Alaska, the Yukon, and BC, which makes for a really, you know, interesting spectrum of types of films. We have world premieres of first-time filmmakers, as well as U.S. premieres of films that premiere at festivals like Hot Docs or Rotterdam or South By. I guess that's a Seattle premiere, but, you know, so it's a really fascinating festival to organize because you don't have the typical constrictions of being an international film festival that's just in a blanket sense trying to find, you know, the best or the newest batch of films. We're focused on kind of discovering new voices in this region and supporting the ongoing development of careers of filmmakers in this region. And the festival this year is a really interesting mix. We have a documentary about a Lebanese immigrant who runs a deli in Vancouver, who also is a former male escort. And
as you do.
Yeah, as
That's
you do.
Thing.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. It premiered at South By. It's called The Sandwich Nazi, and it's unlike
quality title.
Any kind of profile of a subject that you've ever seen. I mean, this guy is truly one in a million. There's a really awesome feature, first-time feature by a DP here in Seattle named Isaiah Corey. The film is called Killing June, and it's a very simple premise. It's very hard to pull off, which is that a woman, June, decides to knock off the items on a bucket list before she kills herself in a week. But it's a comedy. It's a black comedy. And it's one of those where you start watching it, you're like, this premise, I don't know if they'll be able to deliver on it. But he totally does. It's ambitious aesthetically and in its narrative scope. And it's a really great debut. So excited to be premiering that. And then just one more. The first feature film ever shot in the Tuareg language, which is from North Africa, the South Berber people speak it, and it's called, oh God, I actually have to look at my notes if that's okay to pronounce it, and I'll probably still butcher it.
Give it a whirl.
We'll certainly learn it in time for the festival.
I won't know
you
if it's wrong.
Yeah.
I don't think any of us
we
will
won't
know
tell
if it's
anyone.
Wrong.
The internet will tell us.
Yes.
It's Akunak Tedalat Taha Tazugai, and it's essentially Purple Rain. It's sort of a Purple Rain remake.
This is great.
This
in
is
the
awesome.
Sahara.
Love the sound of this.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's from Portland.
Adam, did your movie premiere?
My movie, in fact, did premiere. At
I was going to say.
This is a film I was involved with a number of years ago, premiered at STIFF, and we actually won an award. We won one of the, I can't remember what the actual, it was a Stiffy. Gotcha. That's what it was. It was a Pyrex stiffy.
For the Mormon zombie movie.
Yep. The Book of Zombie. Yeah.
But I love that you bring that up, Adam, and I love that you talked about your partnership with Scarecrow, because the Northwest Film Forum, you have a rich history of local partnerships. I mean, you partner with SIFF, you partner with $3 Bill Cinema, you partner with just about anybody in Seattle that's interested in showcasing film. Why keep doing that? Why is this important? I mean, I probably already know the answer, but still.
Well, you know, I think the answer to that is also evolving as the landscape of independent film exhibition does. There are really important philosophical and spiritual and artistic reasons why we've always had a strong partnership-based model for our programming, which is that we love providing space and platforms for sharing new work, you know. So everything from every single year, we partner with the Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, as well as the Translations Film Festival. We've also been kind of opening up to even more festivals in terms of hosting. So the Asian American Film Festival, Seattle. Last year, we also had the Social Justice Film Festival, the Deaf Film Festival. We've partnered with the Polish Film Festival. And just in the month of October, I think we'll be hosting Lesbian and Gay Festival, doing an event with the Polish Festival, the Seattle Latino Film Festival, and the South Asian Film Festival, in addition to other partnerships. So the other thing that I think is increasingly important is to work with communities to kind of provide the space of the theater itself as a resource to be used by other groups and communities, as opposed to constantly having it be like purely our own curatorial stamp on everything. So there's both the artistic reasons that I think that makes sense to just provide audiences with a more kind of diverse array of types of films and types of perspectives presenting those films. But also, honestly, pragmatically, I find it a really interesting adaptive strategy to what's happening with the distribution and exhibition of independent film, which is that the kind of regular theatrical run by which many theaters scaffold their programming is less and less tenable. You know, in many ways, it's making sense to adapt by doing more events that are in partnership with other audience spaces, and I'm doing that to kind of bolster the calendar.
Excellent. So Courtney Sheehan, Northwest Film Forum, how do we get more information?
You can always find us at nwfilmforum.org. We're also newly on Instagram, finally, NW Film Forum, and of course Facebook and Twitter as well. And please always feel welcome to stop on by. Our location is at 1515 12th Ave, right in the heart of the Pike Pine corridor of Capitol Hill. And even before our screenings start in the evening, we also have our office hours during the day, and we're always happy to talk to anybody who wants to just come in and find out more about what's going on.
Excellent. Very much. Well, Courtney Sheehan, Program Director of Northwest Film Forum, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again for having
me. Thank you, Courtney.
Thanks.
Okie dokie. So in summary, Ant-Man, talking about what we've seen here over these last few weeks, two theater, one rent for Ant-Man, Minions getting a pretty solid skip from all of us, Amy getting a couple of us saying, see that in the theater, Mr. Holmes, two theaters, Pixels. Sarah, you were saying, again, that was, were you giving that a skip?
I gave it a skip.
Yeah, okay, a skip on that. I didn't even write down what we were saying on that.
It was a mild skip, though.
Right, and Southpaw comes in with two rentals, one skip, and that pretty much does it for us here on Cinema Squabble. If you wanted to hear more on what we've got going, you can always check out MovieFreak.com for what Sarah's got cooking. Also, The Examiner and Zitzel Film for what Brian's got going on. I'm Adam Gerke. You can find out what I've got going on at AdamGerke.com, and so much more at CinemaSquabble.com. You can find us at iTunes.com as well. This is Cinema Squabble, and much thanks to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer. A number of cinema... Perfect.